Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
So it is, of course, summertime. And look, that is a very mixed bag around the country. But as a whole, Australia has the highest melanoma rates in the world. In fact, melanoma is often called Australia's national cancer. And with around 70% of melanomas coming onto highly visible areas, your face, your head, your neck, many patients need life-saving cancer surgery, and they're often left with a bit of initial disfigurement as well. We can talk about impaired vision, breathing, speech or facial movement might be hard to do. So reconstructive procedures are critical to restoring these essential functions, from blinking to protect the eye, nasal airflow, facial movement, everything in between. And of course, so a person can look like themselves post-surgery. Now, Dr. David Sparks is a fully certified plastic and reconstructive surgeon. He's a member of the Australian Society of Plastic Surgeons and a fellow of the Royal Australian College of Surgeons. He's trained in major public and private hospitals around Brisbane, around Sydney, the Gold Coast. He has a PhD in regenerative medicine and also currently serves as a lecturer at the University of Queensland. He joins us now, breaking into his holidays, not from sunny Queensland, but rather from Vancouver in Canada, where I hope the technology gods are smiling on us. I imagine it's very cold and very early. David, hello, are you with me?
Hey, Nick, thanks for having me. Yes, it is very cold, I can report. Currently wearing a beanie and a jumper in my apartment over here.
Very happy to have you on, all the way over from our fellow country of the Commonwealth. Now, look, lines are open as well. Very keen to have a bit of a conversation around here, whether that's about plastic surgery, reconstructive, or more generally. 1-300-800-222. On that text line, 0467-922-702. The funny thing is, David, you mentioned plastic surgery, and many people kind of immediately think of, how would I put it, cosmetic procedures made popular by Hollywood. We don't necessarily immediately think medically necessary. It's a very different world. So maybe we can start by talking about what sort of challenges can you find yourself facing after life-saving cancer removal surgery?
Yeah, so it's kind of, it's one of those things that, you'll have to bear with me. I've got a little bit of a runny nose.
In Canada, I completely understand. No, you're fine.
plastic surgeons, our craft is sometimes misunderstood, I guess. I still get patients coming into the clinic asking me that if I use plastic in my surgeries.
Oh.
It's pretty interesting. Like plastikos is actually the Greek word for molding. And so plastic surgeons evolved, essentially the specialty evolved out of, molding, different areas of, tissue into others. So reconstructing an area and using other tissue nearby or from, another location to reconstruct what is lost. And that's kind of, bread and butter of what we do. And that sort of translates into how we deal with cosmetic surgery as well. Having the ability to try and reconstruct something that's lost also gives you the ability to try and augment or enhance something as it stands. So, challenges after life-saving cancer removal, it really depends on a whole range of factors, like specifically sort of tumor factors, so like the cancer factors, the type of cancer, where it is, how far progressed it was when it was diagnosed, and then sort of patient factors, like the health of the patient, previous treatments or surgeries, and then whatever planned treatments that they may have, after having surgery, this sort of thing. So, the goals are fairly simple. You want to restore the form and function to the best of your ability, and this sort of takes into account the aesthetic component of what we do as well. The challenges can be, returning something that's kind of lost to appear like what it is, or what it was beforehand. And that obviously can be pretty challenging. There's specific areas in the face that make that particularly difficult: the eyebrows, the eyelids, the nose, lips, mouth, and ears. And another challenging consideration is when, the nerves of the face are, involved by cancer, or they need to be resected to safely remove the cancer. And one particular nerve, the facial nerve that allows your facial muscle expression and that sort of thing. And that can be partial or complete loss, depending on what is, removed and that sort of thing. These particular issues, these cancer-related issues leading to loss of nerve function and deformities in the face from surgery and other treatments, they kind of lead to pretty significant sort of toll on the patient, not just from a functional point of view, but also from a psychological point of view.
David, I have to say, I was actually surprised at how much function we can lose from these surgeries. And I think it goes a little bit to the fact that too often, I think Australians, we still gloss over things like skin cancer. It's just something that we think of as it just happens. It's worth noting that particularly melanoma, face and neck, very dangerous.
Yeah. Yep. Melanoma in the face and neck. I mean, the sun exposure of the face and neck through your lifetime is considerable, especially in Southeast Queensland, and also very aggressive. My uncle actually died from a melanoma on the back of his neck in the last year or two. So it affects a lot of people throughout Australia. Australia and New Zealand have, the highest rates of melanoma in the world. From a cancer surgeon point of view, plastic surgeons, we manage the lion's share of all of the head and neck melanoma in Queensland. And this kind of varies from state to state in terms of, which type of surgeon will manage head and neck melanoma. But for the most part, cutaneous or sort of, skin origin cancers in the head and neck area, plastic surgeons deal mostly with those. ENT surgeons also deal with them as well. And are the other main surgeons that manage those. But plastic surgeons are the main surgeons, at least in Queensland, who perform reconstructive surgery to try and, fix these. And that's particularly the case for melanoma in the head and neck with obviously fairly significant implications for, when the tissue is, when the area has been removed and then what to do about it afterwards, whether that's moving tissue in that's adjacent or, moving tissue in from somewhere else in the body.
So, David, there are scenarios where you're working with other surgeons rather than you doing the whole process.
Yeah, so we sort of it depends. So for large cancer excisions where the cancer comes from the skin, I'll do the excision or removal of the cancer, and that can be. That can range from a whole, series of different sort of operations, whether that's, removal of the eyelids and the eye from the eye socket if there's a cancer that's involving that area from the skin, or if there's a cancer that involves the lower lip, removing the lower lip and sometimes part of the jawbone underneath. And then, other things like, other aggressive sort of surgeries. For melanoma and for other sort of head and neck cancers, though, we manage all of these patients in what's called a multidisciplinary clinic. So we have a range of specialists in that clinic, as well as allied health and nursing staff as well. And basically everyone sort of comes together to kind of decide what the best, decision is for that particular patient, what surgery would benefit them, and then what additional treatments would benefit them, and also whether or not surgery is not the right decision for them at all, and whether or not no treatment, so palliation, or it's not no treatment, but a palliative pathway where they're supported through their disease process that will take their life, and then there's also other treatments, especially in melanoma, where we sort of surgery is really changing a lot. Because we're doing a lot less surgery for really aggressive head and neck melanomas than what we were in the past, and that's really great for patients.
Why is that? What are you doing instead?
So instead, we're actually using medications. So we use an immunotherapy agent. The medical oncologists are the ones prescribing it, and they do the management of the patients. But basically, it stimulates the immune system from a basic concept point of view. It stimulates, ramps up the immune system to sort of recognize that the melanoma is there and that the body needs to get rid of the melanoma. effectively. You get pretty dramatic results for some patients. But at the same time, it's not a panacea. It's not something that solves the problem for everybody. And, you know, there's a portion of patients, a significant portion of patients that don't derive a benefit from immunotherapy. And for those patients, you know, salvage resection and things like that is also an option for them. It's a multidisciplinary sort of process involving a lot of specialists to sort of get the best decision making for patients.
You kind of mentioned it a bit earlier, talking about how delicate faces are, if we're being perfectly honest, how many nerves, how many different types of organs. I'm kind of keen, like, how would you help someone, for example, who's, after this surgery, having trouble blinking?
Yeah, so blinking, it really depends on, I guess, the cause of the blinking. So if it's related to, you know, like an irreversible loss of nerve function, you know, such as like the nerve was removed with a, you know, a cancer of the, you know, saliva gland in the cheek. There's a number of options you can try and use to restore function to these patients, because obviously closure of the eye is really important for protecting the eye. And, you know, patients can get very irritated eyes, and then also can get, you know, ulcerations on the cornea, so the outer layer of the eye. You know, if not treated, some of these patients can effectively go blind. So it's pretty important to reconstruct that, you know, that component to their eyelid function. And so what is pretty interesting, actually, we used to use gold plates. Instead, now we use platinum plates. And so it's like a tiny little plate. It weighs about, you know, 1.6 grams, or in a female, it's about 1.4 grams. And we make an incision in the upper eyelid, dissect down, and you've got this thing called the tarsus. It's basically like a little bit of it's like hardened sort of tissue. It's like, you know, almost like cartilage, and it sits in the upper eyelid, right where your eyelashes are, just above the eyelash area. And basically we put this tiny little weight and stitch it into that little bit of cartilage under the skin and under the muscle, and what it does is, you know, it allows them to, you know, naturally close their eye. Because at baseline, the nerve that allows the eyelid to open is still functioning, right? That's a different nerve. And so at baseline, they'll want to keep that eyelid open. So by putting a weight in there, gravity will allow them to just enough sort of closure to get that eyelid closed. And they've got another muscle innervated by a different nerve, which allows them to partially, you know, trigger that eyelid closure. But there's other things we do. We tighten the lower eyelid, and there's lots of other things we can do to try and improve eyelid function for these, you know, these patients and restore blink. But that's a, you know, there are certain things you can't completely restore, like a natural blink in these patients. You can at least get them to close their eye, and, you know, for the most part, it's sort of spontaneously triggered by them.
You mentioned also moving tissue around for some treatments. You know, I'm thinking of sort of how badly sun on lips can affect people. Like, can you recreate lips?
Yeah. So, I mean, lips can be tricky, but lots can be done to try and fix these after removal of cancer. So often small cancers of the lip, you can close them directly. It's called a wedge excision, where you basically, you know, excise a full thickness of the lip, just a small amount. And then just stitch it up. And that just creates like a linear scar in the lip, like a straight line scar. For sort of bigger cancers where there's sort of like maybe like a third to half of the lower lip is involved by a cancer, often we'll use what are called like lip sharing procedures. And that's sort of where we move, you know, part of the adjacent lip, whether that's the upper lip or typically it's the, like, either the side or the central upper lip for a lower lip area, or the lower lip for an upper lip area that's affected. And then sometimes we slide, we make back cuts and we slide both sides of the upper lips down to recreate the whole lower lip, or at least a significant portion of the lower lip, on the contrary, taking both of the lower taking the lower lip and a little bit of the upper lip either side to reconstruct like a central loss of upper lip area. So that's what we sort of do for, you know, I guess near total lip reconstruction. Sometimes you don't have that option, right? So if you've got, you know, your entire lower lip's gone, and this patient's got a very, you know, effectively quite a tight mouth, their upper lip is, you know, scarred, or there's some other issue, and you're unable to use any of that, what you can do is you can actually take their forearm skin. So we take the skin, a little bit of fat, and then we also take a muscle tendon in the forearm, and we take this as what's called a flap. So it's a free flap, and we call it a free flap because it's, you know, freely disconnected from this area on the forearm. And with its blood vessels, we connect up the blood vessels in the neck. So, you know, reconstitute that blood supply to the tissue, stitch the skin in to reconstruct the lip, and then also use that tendon to support the, you know, continence, I guess, of the lower lip. So that's called free tissue transfer. It's a sort of a fairly pioneering technique that was developed in the 1970s, and it was actually developed in Australia, in Melbourne. I know you're from Melbourne. You're from Victoria, aren't you?
I am. I'm in regional Victoria right now. But that is, I mean, are we, in terms of that, I know Australia tends to be an innovative country, but are we sort of on the cutting edge of, no pun intended, some of the work you're doing?
Australia's got a very rich history for plastic surgery.
Wow.
We've got some, you know, very prominent figures in the world historically for plastic surgery. One of those surgeons I've worked with, he's still alive as well, Professor Ian Taylor, is a fantastic man, and along with some other surgeons down in Victoria. Professor Wayne Morrison is another, you know, pioneering plastic surgeon down there as well. So there's a very rich, very rich history in Australia of plastic surgery. And, you know, you go to these, you know, international microsurgery conferences, you know, and, you know, they're paying tribute to, you know, these two legends of plastic surgery, you know, all people from all over the world. So they're extremely well known, well respected, and there's a whole range of other plastic surgeons in Australia that have contributed significantly to the specialty. Professor Bernie O'Brien, who passed away many years ago, I think several years ago. I can't remember exactly when he passed away, but it was a while ago. But they're probably the major figures, I guess.
You're with me, Nick Healy. We're live around the nation on Nightlife. I'm sitting in for Phil Clark for the next couple of weeks. But our guest right now, specialist plastic and reconstructive surgeon, Dr. David Sparks, who is generously giving up some of his time from over in Canada, in Vancouver, wee small hours where he is right now, chatting about plastic surgery for reconstruction, particularly after cancer surgery. Would love to hear from you if you've got questions or want to join the conversation. It's 1-300-800-222. A couple of texts coming in, which I will get to, 0467-922-702. I mean, David, when we talk about facial scarring in particular, I mean, that outside of, I guess, some of the loss of function we were talking about, can have really profound impacts on a social or even psychological level.
Yeah, absolutely. The facial palsy, you know, which is effectively either the partial or complete lack of facial movement. You know, and typically this is one-sided, but, you know, not always the case. There are some congenital syndromes for, you know, patients who are born with effectively both facial nerves not being there. So, and they have a bilateral facial palsy at, you know, right from birth. So it can have pretty dramatic consequences for patients, you know, from a psychological point of view, having this, you know, inability to express emotions the way other people can. And obviously that's such an important part of, you know, your day-to-day communication. And as a, you know, consequence, people really suffer. And, you know, it has fairly significant effects on their quality of life. And we know that, you know, just from, you know, we know that because, you know, it makes sense, right? But also there's a lot of data to suggest that these patients do do have a significant, reduced quality of life secondary to their facial palsy. there's a lot of things that can be done to try and help them through that process. There's psychologists who, can help them. But there's also lots of, non-surgical and surgical treatments to try and, improve things for them. Often, especially with a complete facial palsy, it's very difficult to completely get things back to normal. And it's all about, kind of managing expectations. But at the same time, depending on how significant the palsy is, certain things can be done to try and improve their baseline facial symmetry, as well as, their dynamic facial expressions, such as like smile, eyelid closure, these sorts of things. So, there's a lot of nuanced techniques in that respect as well. One of those is actually taking the one of the muscles in the thigh with the blood vessels and the nerve. And what we do is the muscle in your cheek that allows you to sort of clench your jaw, it's called the masseter muscle. We take the nerve that goes to the masseter and we connect it to, so we basically transplant that muscle from the thigh with its nerve and blood vessels, connect up the blood vessels, and then with the nerve branch that goes to the muscle, the one in the cheek that goes to that clenching muscle, we connect it to the muscle we've transplanted, and we stitch that muscle into the face in the right vector to try and restore smile. And what you get, with a lot of rehab and a lot of training, fortunately, if you look at, functional MRI sort of studies looking at the motor cortex and exactly where, initiation of clench clenching your jaws effectively and the cross activity that you get with smile, fortunately, they're relatively close to each other and there's a lot of synergy in that type of movement of the face. So when these patients, you retrain them to clench their mouth, they initiate smile on that side of their face. So it's obviously, not the absolute, you're not recreating something completely, you're not putting them back to normal, but it goes a long way. And I think, there's good data also to say that, if you are to improve patient's smile and sort of baseline, expression, you can significantly improve their quality of life.
1-300-800-222 if you want to join in the conversation. David, this might be more of a question for a cancer specialist, but just given where you work, I'll put it to you, and no dramas if it's not in your bailiwick. Linda in South Australia saying, what is the difference between a melanoma and a basal cell carcinoma?
Yeah, so, skin cancer is something I deal with all the time. So melanoma is it's a different type of cancer altogether. I like to think of like basal cell carcinoma, it's sort of on a spectrum. Basal cell carcinoma, sort of like generally a lower grade, sort of locally growing skin cancer. It does take quite a long time to become a major problem. You can get on top of it fairly quickly. Mm. Squamous cell carcinoma is sort of like they're keratinocyte, cancers. So they come from the outer layers of the skin. The squamous cell carcinoma is a little bit more aggressive than basal cell carcinomas, and they grow locally, but also they can kind of spread. They don't spread that often, but they do tend to spread if you leave them long enough. And then melanomas, they actually arise from melanocytes, and so these are like your melanin-producing cells of your skin. They give that sort of pigmentation, that sort of baseline skin tone that you have, and then also your nevi that you see on your skin are all congregations of melanocytes. So it's a separate type of cell that causes melanoma than it is to basal cells, right? So basal cells come from the actual sort of skin epithelium where the skin sort of forms, and melanomas, unfortunately, they're quite aggressive when you compare them to say a basal cell carcinoma. So melanomas will They can spread quickly. They spread to the lymph nodes, and they can also spread throughout your body. Sometimes they can spread throughout your body without spreading to the lymph nodes. But we know, you know, most classically that patients, you know, will present, you know, with, if they've got an aggressive melanoma, we know that the, you know, if it's, you know, got a certain thickness, the best thing to do is obviously to remove it, but at the same time to sample the lymph node nearby from where the melanoma is. And that gives a very good sort of insight into how aggressive that melanoma is and where it's traveling. And if it's in the lymph node, then there's, you know, that means that it's probably more aggressive, and, you know, further surgery, or, you know, nowadays patients go for immunotherapy for the most part if they need it. Not every patient needs it, you know, if it has spread beyond the lymph node, immunotherapy is often indicated.
Dr. David Sparks is our guest. Now, I know, David, you live and work on the Gold Coast. Paul in Canberra, this is an interesting one to me. He's saying, are melanomas, is it worse when you're in altitude? He says, I understand UV can be worse at altitude. And certainly where you are, I think people would know that the sun feels a lot harsher the further north you go.
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly as you get closer to the equator, you know, you're obviously going to feel a lot more of that. There are, I guess, different sort of atmospheric changes, I guess, you know, in different parts of the world. And they can also have an effect on, I guess, how much UV radiation gets down to where you are. I guess the most important thing to realize is that, you know, UV will get there regardless. You know, if it's a cloudy day, you're going to get UV radiation exposure. And I guess that's something that's, you know, particularly important to remember. You know, it's just one of those things. It's sort of like, you know, sun exposure, obviously, it's a pretty, you know, necessary component of, you know, daily life, right? You sort of need it for, you know, hormone production like vitamin D, you know, sleep regulation, mood stability, all these sort of things, right? You know, everyone's, I'm sure, heard of this, you know, seasonal affective disorder in the UK and that sort of thing, where you basically just get really depressed because you just don't get any sun. But the issue in Australia, I guess, you know, is that, yeah, your UV radiation exposure, you get that pretty quickly. And, you know, there's more sunny days in places like Queensland, in places, you know, sort of, I guess, more north. And that probably also contributes to, I guess, you know, a higher amount of UV exposure at baseline. But also patients are probably more likely, or people are more likely to go out in the sun, you know, because it's, you know, I guess, more comforting weather. so there's lots of other things to consider there as well.
Latitude, not altitude, asks Phil, and I think that's kind of what you've been describing here. Georgie's texted in saying, my father, who she adds is in his 80s, had skin cancers burned off his face for pretty much his entire adult life. A couple of years ago, he was diagnosed with melanoma and underwent 7 weeks of radiation therapy. He saw a plastic surgeon who decided he would not work a surgery on him because it would be too invasive and unhelpful. Now, obviously, you can't comment directly on a case you haven't seen, but would there be generally scenarios where plastic surgery would not come into the equation?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, sorry. So there's certainly situations where, you know, you might encounter a patient who, you know, has had multiple treatments in the past you know, a patient who's had multiple treatments in the past, whether that's radiation or whether that's, you know, medical treatments, they've got a significant number of medical comorbidities, they're very unhealthy, and they're not really fit for, you know, having a complicated plastic surgery operation that needs several hours, you know, under a general anaesthetic. These patients, you know, an operation for them is actually, you know, the worst thing you can do because they may well not survive the operation. So, you know, it's all a balance. And that's where, you know, earlier I was talking about multidisciplinary team management for cancer, especially head and neck cancer. And, you know, that's where we sit in a room, you know, a dark room, and look at all of the radiology, you know, all of the pictures and imaging pictures for all the patients that are, you know, presenting to the clinic. And we, you know, we have a discussion about each individual patient. And, you know, you've got, you know, sometimes, you know, 20 different specialists sitting in a room talking about and discussing you know, what we think is the best treatment for an individual patient. And I think that this is, you know, this is a pretty tremendous, fantastic thing we have in Australia, the ability to, you know, you go to a public hospital and you will be seen, and then 20 specialists will sit down in a room, look at all of your details, all of your imaging, all of your results, and then after they've seen you clinically, make a decision about, you know, collectively what the right thing is for you. And so a lot of these decisions that are made, it's not just one person that's making them. It's a collective decision from a whole range of people with individual expertise in their area of specialty.
That was going to be my question, is sort of how many people are doing what you do? How accessible is this form of reconstructive surgery to the average Australian?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's very accessible. You know, if patients have aggressive cancers, you know, going to the public hospital system to get them treated is a good thing to do. You will get treatment quickly. You know, wait lists and things like that for other types of cancers, you know, varies between different locations, different hospitals, different health networks and things like that. But certainly for any major cancers, patients are, you know, seen and treated within, you know, definitely within 30 days.
Well, on that note, Jacinta's just texted saying, I had a biopsy before Christmas, was told it was a squamous cancer just above my lip. I'm going into Peter Mac on 29th of January. Is that waiting too long for a discussion on what the treatment should be?
I mean, it's difficult for me to, like, comment on, you know, because I don't have the pathology. And sometimes, you know, carcinoma actually is something completely different from the pathology form, so and how it's interpreted. So it's sort of, I can't really comment on, you know, that particular situation. But you know, if it's a small lesion, an intraepithelial carcinoma or something like that, you know, or even a small squamous cell carcinoma, you know, waiting a month or you know, up to, you know, 45 or 60 days for treatment, you know, is not totally unnecessary, you know, like not, you know, not out of the, you know, what would be considered normal or standard. You know, and I think that's sort of, it's a triage, you know, there's only so many resources you've got, right? So that's the whole thing with, you know, treating patients in the public hospital system is that you've only got so many resources that you can use to try and, to treat people. And so you have to, you know, people with aggressive cancers get treated, you know, very quickly, and patients with less aggressive cancers, they don't get treated very quickly.
We've got a couple of minutes before I let David finally go.
Not always the case that they don't get treated very quickly, but all of the cancers get treated as quickly as effectively they're needed to be treated.
Yeah, I understand, so within that sort of triage environment. Yeah. Now, a couple of minutes before I finally let David go and rest his poor throat and nose, 1-300-800-222. We were talking about sort of what a difference plastic surgeries in general and reconstructive surgeries can make to people's lives. Lee's got in touch from the Sunshine Coast saying, I had a tram procedure after breast surgery for cancer done by a fabulous surgeon. She gives a shout out to David in Brisbane. My quality of life is as close as it could be without my breast cancer. He was skilled and a wonderful support during my recovery. I cannot thank him enough. And I think it's a really good indicator of just what a difference this can make.
Yeah. So, tram breast reconstruction, and more commonly now what we do is what's called a Dieppe flap, which is a system effectively the same type of flap. It's just, you just don't take as much muscle. In fact, you don't take any. And that's basically, effectively you do like a tummy tuck. Mm. So you take the lower skin and fat of the belly and then the blood vessels, and then you transfer that to the breasts to recreate the breasts. It gives, you know, similar to what, you know, a breast augmentation would do, it gives volume to the breasts, right? But the value really is that, you know, this is their tissue, right? This is their their skin and fat that you're moving, and, you know, reconstructing their breasts with. So it's sort of them. Implants have a whole range of problems that they can, you know, that they can generate when used for breast reconstruction, especially in patients that have had radiation treatment. And so, you know, we use implants for breast reconstruction as well, but you know, for a lot of patients, a DEB breast reconstruction can be, you know, transformative for the patient.
In terms of timing for some of this work, an interesting question that's come in from Karen, saying my husband had a melanoma on his ear back in 1988. Had a fabulous surgeon, Bill. He had a partial penectomy and neck dissection. I'm really thankful he's had so many clear follow-ups. He's still here. But what would be the options for someone like him, she asks, with plastic surgery for his ear as his hair starts to fall out? It doesn't seem to have come along very far in terms of the conversations, I think.
So the hair loss associated with where the radiation treatment was?
I think it's more that as his hair loss is happening, maybe the work on the ear is becoming more visible, is I think what Karen's saying.
Right, yeah, okay. So there are things you can do to try and, I guess, you know, cover up portions of the ear where the, you know, the ear's been taken away from cancer. One of those is you can do like a prosthesis. That can be something that you can literally, you know, put on the ear that's made by a prosthetist. Yeah. And they can almost like stick it onto the ear and adhere it there. Often though, it will fall off if you did that. So there are other things that we kind of use as well. And one of those is actually called osseointegration. So, and depending on whether they're suitable or not, there's a whole range of factors that should be considered, right? But you basically put a screw or a number of screws into the bone where the just behind where the ear is, and a portion of a prosthetic is basically made that sort of clicks or magnetically attaches to that to those screws, and that's sort of, I guess, more commonly used for total ear loss or like subtotal ear loss. If it's only a partial or, you know, a small portion of the ear or maybe, you know, 30% or something like that, there might be some other revision plastic surgery procedure that can be done to try and fix it. But that will create more scar. But it may recreate more ear. It's unlikely to look effectively the same as the other side. But, you know, things can be done to try and improve this, I guess. It just depends on the case, and there's obviously I can't talk to that case or about it in particular.
Michael's on the line. He's called in from the Gold Coast. Michael, what did you want to ask?
Oh, hello, David. Yeah, Michael here. Very interesting. I was just wondering why some people get melanoma on the sole of their feet where there's not much sun exposure.
So Bob Marley had a melanoma on his foot, an acral-antigenous melanoma, and that's what that was actually the cause of death for him. So it's sort of more common in skin of colour. It's a primary melanocytic, origin similar to other causes of melanoma, but it's significantly more aggressive. It moves quicker is, I guess, a little bit more resistant to more established treatment options. Even things like immunotherapy, very effective at, you know, removing melanoma. But, we don't see these cases very often. We do see them. We don't see them very often, but, it's all about sort of managing these cases in an MDT and then, you know, coming up with a plan for the patient that's appropriate. But melanoma origin on the foot, yeah, very aggressive and moves quick.
Michael, thank you very much for calling in. I have to ask, David, I mean, outside of reconstructive work, when it comes to, cosmetic procedures, popular ones, what are we getting a lot of in Australia?
Cosmetic procedures.
Yeah.
So common cosmetic procedures, I think, I mean, obviously breast augmentation is a very common cosmetic procedure, rhinoplasty, so the nose job. And then I think something that's sort of, I guess, come, you know, I was always a relatively common procedure, but recently with a lot of social media and all that sort of thing, facelifts have sort of become particularly, I guess, towards the forefront of plastic surgery. Yeah, it's interesting. You see these sort of shifts, I guess, with, you know, what is in vogue, you know, and it certainly is the case that there definitely is sort of like a, you know, almost a rotation to some extent of some of these sort of higher volume type cosmetic procedures. Yeah, procedures like breast augmentation and rhinoplasty and, you know, those two procedures by themselves probably, I would say, consume quite a lot of, you know, plastic surgeon time, I guess, in terms of, you know, treating these particular conditions. Other procedures, you know, breast lift, you know, abdominoplasty, you know, like a tummy tuck effectively. And then for, you know, patients that have massive weight loss, so, you know, removing all the excess skin. And that's become, you know, a very important way for patients to deal with, you know, all of the excess skin that they develop after going on either, you know, the weight loss medications or, you know, going on, you know, having bariatric surgery, where all of that weight is sort of, you know, is gone and effectively managed. That's a, you know, obviously, a series of procedures, you know, taking the skin and the fat from the whole circumference of the lower, you know, sort of torso, as well as tightening the arms and tightening the thighs.
David, I'm going to let you go because it is the wee small hours, but you have been absolutely fantastic to take a bit of time and thank you. Please enjoy the rest of your Canadian break, but thanks for having a chat on Nightlife.
Thanks very much for having me, Nick.
Thank you. A slightly unwell, sadly, Dr. David Spark, specialist plastic and reconstructive surgeon. As I said, member of the Australian Society of Plastic Surgeons, fellow of the Royal Australian College of Surgeons, a very, very smart man who's been doing a lot of work in this space for quite a while.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.